You've sent in your thoughts on 20 passages that you selected from the list around the theme of clashing worldviews, idolatry, pluralism, compromise in the biblical period. Of course, the list was longer than just 20, and so I'll be sharing my thoughts on all of them. Feel free to jump ahead if you want to skip the passages that you did not choose, but you may benefit from listening to the whole thing, and really it should only be about 30% longer than if you just listen to the parts on your scriptures. I'm going to go straight through the list, which is not necessarily in chronological or even logical order, but it is in the biblical order, and that'll make it easier for me and for you. Joshua has taken the lead from Moses, a people who had really made terrible progress. They'd really gone backwards after the Exodus, suffered for it. A whole generation will die out. Joshua reminds them of the pagan background they came from. And so I read in verses 14 and 15. Now therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in faithfulness. Put away the gods that your father served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. And if it is evil in your eyes to serve the Lord, choose this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your father served in the region beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. That last sentence in Joshua 24:15 is very famous, and it's probably on the walls of some of you listening to this this little lesson. Let me just share what I see in this passage. He reminds them of the idolatry that was part of their culture and the polytheism beyond the river. And here we'd be talking about the Euphrates. We're talking about when Abram was called in Genesis 11 and 12, when Abram's family was called, and Abram was called to leave idolatry. Even when they were in Egypt, they still were struggling with idolatry. And there were many gods in Egypt. If you ever go to a museum of ancient culture, take a look at these gods. It is amazing stuff. Anyway, the plagues, of course, the 10 plagues, were all targeting at least one Egyptian god and making them look like fools and making them look completely impotent. So Joshua reminds them of the futility and the reality of their idolatry and polytheism, and calls them to make a decision and reminds them that they're going into a culture which is just as messed up as the culture that they came from. And the Amorites, we would call them the Canaanites, the people who lived in the Promised Land, will be a great source of temptation for the Jews. And as we know, they will only have mixed success. Judges 6, 28 to 32. This is in part part of the Midian, the Gideon story. Yeah, Gideon is fighting Midian later on. Gideon destroys the altar of Baal. When the men of the town rose early in the morning, behold, the altar of Baal was broken down, and the Asherah beside it was cut down. And the second bull was offered on the altar that had been built. And they said to one another, who has done this thing? And after they had searched and inquired, they said, Gideon, the son of Joash, has done this thing. And then the men of the town said to Joash, bring out your son that he may die, for he has broken down the altar of Baal and cut down the Asherah beside it. But Joash said to all who stood against him, will you contend for Baal, or will you save him? Whoever contends for him shall be put to death by morning. If he is a god, let him contend for himself, because his altar has been broken down. Therefore, on that day, Gideon was called Jerubbaal, that is to say, let Baal contend against him, because he broke down his altar. So this second scripture comes from the period after Joshua. Judges really begins where Joshua leaves off. There's a little bit of overlap, but Judges is simply a sad saga of a cycle of compromise and despair and repentance and then self-satisfaction and compromise again. It just goes on and on. And so few people will take a stand. And I think it's the same in our culture today. How many people will really take a stand? We may not be directly worshiping Baal or Baal, the weather god, but in our modern society, we worship just about everything else. And it's rare to find someone who'll take a stand. Gideon, and in this case, Gideon's father, Joash, points out the illogic of idolatry. I mean, if this guy's really a god, wouldn't he be able to defend himself? The things that we worship in our society and the gods that are worshipped in our world, if they were real, wouldn't there be some evidence of that? Whether it's the god of money or power or the military or sex or the false gods of the Hindu pantheon or the gods worshipped in Africa or China or other parts of the world. So what he does seems to be very destructive. It's iconoclastic, and yet God commends him here. I go ahead to chapter 9 of Judges, and this is just a sidelight. I won't explain too much of the passage, but Abimelech, the son of Yerubbaal, that's Gideon's new name, he goes to Shechem, and you know it's not going in a very good place. But there's a comment about the gods. He's telling a little parable, and I'll back up to verse 12. The trees said to the vine, "You come and reign over us." Verse 13. The vine said to them, "Shall I leave my wine that cheers God and men and go hold sway over the trees?" Or you could translate it, "that cheers gods and men," because the word God is often plural. And what that shows us is that the common view of the gods was that they had foibles, tendencies, just like us humans. Think of the ancient Nordic pantheon. Think of Thor, Odin, Loki. Think of the Greek pantheon with Zeus and Hermes, Athena. Think of the Roman pantheon, Jupiter, Minerva, Juno, and so forth. The stories that you learned in grammar school, these gods were deceitful, they were unreliable, they were immoral, they have affairs, they bear grudges, they take revenge, they're violent, they get drunk. And although the gods may be different in the Old Testament world, their tendencies are the same. I think of the tendencies of dictators in our world. Sometimes I get a bit nervous when I visit a country that's led by a dictator, and I know how power corrupts. I believe that the gods that were created by these ancient religions are really the same, no different than humans, under the corrupting influence of power. And so this little passage has the gods being cheered by wine. It's not a big point in the passage, but it shows us the nature of these divinities. In short, they're not worth worshiping. And I hope these things I'm sharing are giving you ideas. Now we go to chapter 16 of Judges. I think in Judges we see this clash between worldviews, between monotheism and polytheism, very clearly, and that's why I've selected a few of these verses. And this is in the Samson cycle. And I put down 23 to 30, and this is the death of Samson. Of course, the Philistines worshipped Dagon, the corn god. "Now the lords of the Philistines gathered to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god, and to rejoice. And they said, 'Our god has given Samson, our enemy, into our hand.' And when the people saw him, they praised their god. For they said, 'Our God has given our enemy, the ravager of our country, into our hand.'" Now the lords of the Philistines gathered to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon, their god, and to rejoice. And they said, "Our God has given Samson, our enemy, into our hand. When the people saw him, they praised their god, for they said, 'Our God has given our enemy into our hand, the ravager of our country, who has killed many of us.' And when their hearts were merry, they said, 'Call Samson that he may entertain us.' So they called Samson out of the prison, and he entertained them. They made him stand between the pillars. And Samson said to the young man who held him by the hand, 'Let me feel the pillars on which the house rests, that I may lean against them.' Now the house was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there. And on the roof, there were about 3,000 men and women who looked on while Samson entertained. Then Samson called to the Lord and said, 'O Lord God, please remember me and please strengthen me only this once, O God, that I may be avenged on the Philistines for my eyes.' my two eyes. And Samson grasped the two middle pillars on which the house rested, and he leaned his weight against them, his right hand on the one and his left hand on the other. And Samson said, let me die with the Philistines. And then he bowed with all his strength, and the house fell upon the lords and upon all the people who were in it. So the dead whom he killed at his death were more than those whom he had killed during his life. Then his brothers and all his family came down and took him and brought him up and buried him between Zorah and Eshtaol and the tomb of Manoah his father, and he judged Israel 20 years. Well, what do we see here? Samson versus Dagon. Samson is no paragon of spirituality, but at least he does worship the one God. We would never endorse his methods or the violence, which was at this time permitted in the Old Testament. But his life ends with a comeback. Even though he's blind, he still sees clearly who is God, and he takes revenge against the Philistines. And this is one of those great showdowns in the Bible, similar to Elijah on Mount Carmel, you know, against the worshippers of Baal. So these first four passages, Joshua calls the people to a decision. In the second passage, we see Gideon, who takes a stand in this kind of multicultural, polytheistic setting and destroys not only the altar of Baal, but also the Asherah pole. And by the way, Asherah is, you could say, the female consort, the consort of Baal. They're often put together, but she was worshipped as well. And in Judges 9, we saw that the gods, they get drunk. I mean, they're inferior gods. And here's Samson and Dagon, in a physical and a really a military way, epitomize this clash between cultures. In the next passage, I chose 1 Samuel 5, just because it's kind of funny, and it really exposes Dagon for the sham that he is. And I know you read the passage. I'm going to refer to this one. 1 Samuel 5, the ark has been captured by the Philistines, and they put it into the temple of Dagon. And you remember, the next morning, Dagon has fallen face down as in worship, as though Dagon is worshiping the ark. When I was a boy and first heard the story, I thought, wonder what made him fall. Later, I realized, what's the point of this? The point is that Dagon's inferior. The gods all fall down before our true God. Not to say that they have any real existence, but they might as well. And they set Dagon back up. So pathetic. It's like the humor that we find in Isaiah 44. They set him back up, and then he falls again. But this time his hands have fallen off. The hands represent his power, you know, his ability to do things. And his head. He's decapitated. It says only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. And again, I think if you believe in the biblical God, you need to have confidence that if these other gods were real, and they're not, but they would fall down. Allah is not the God of the Bible, but he would fall down if he were real. He would fall down in the presence of the true God. Krishna is not a real God. Some Hindus may believe in him, or Shiva, or Vishnu, or Kali, or Lakshmi, but these gods, even if they were real, they would fall down. Look at the theological point of this passage, that Yahweh is superior to the false gods. Sadly, even though these truths should have been evident, particularly to people who had the law, particularly to those who had been warned, the kings have been warned not to make compromises, to read the scriptures daily. I'm thinking of Deuteronomy 17. Not to get sucked into the vortex, to stand one's ground. Well, it was especially a warning for the king, but it applied to all Israel. But even Solomon, the wisest man, totally slips up. First Kings 11, it says he loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh. Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, Hittite women, from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, you shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clung to these in love. He had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. These were political marriages. Now, perhaps he had a weakness for women too, but I think he just went overboard on the admin and politics side of his job. He marries Pharaoh's daughter. That minimizes the chance that he'll be attacked by Egypt. It's a smooth move. It's a security thing. But all these other women as well, and many of them are royal wives. He has concubines as well, and this seems to be pointless. I mean, unless it's just for pleasure or status. But he has these royal wives, which consolidate his kingdom. And this is a huge theme in the Old Testament, not to put our trust in politics. Never to do that. And the same would be true in the New Testament. He nevertheless enters into marriage, and they turn his heart. And I had written down in the assignment, I guess I gave you up to verse 8, but with the contrast between him and his father David. I mean, David messed up, but he didn't worship other gods. But it mentions some of the false gods that he supported, Solomon supported, Ashtoreth of the Sidonians, and Milcom or Molech. This is the god who required a holocaust, the immolation of one's firstborn child. How he could do that is amazing. He supported Chemosh, the my Bible says the abomination of Moab. Molech. This is just amazing to me. And he supports their religions. So in our multicultural world, should we minimize the differences? Will we reach out to people better if we ignore the differences? Well, the thing is, if we don't have strong conviction, we don't really understand the difference between our God and the false gods, then we'll go the same way. We may not be physically supporting their temples, may not be sending money off to, the local Buddhist foundation. But without conviction, our children will marry those from other faiths. And what does that mean? It means we've lost distinctiveness. We've lost our holiness entirely. The generation is gone. The kids don't see any real need to marry in the faith when their parents are so nice and so respectful to outsiders that they don't see the difference anymore between our God and theirs. Solomon, this is, sadly, the high point of the empire, the kingdom of Israel was under David and then Solomon. And Solomon messes up in so many ways and things really go downhill after this time. Much of it can be attributed to his sin. His son Rehoboam was very insecure. He wasn't a very good leader. Or you could look at it another way. Maybe he was appointed to be leader too soon. But, Solomon was dying. What can we do? So I'm in 1 Kings 12, 26. Rehoboam, Solomon's son, is weak and he's harsh. And Jeroboam exploits this opportunity. He was a former official of Solomon who had to go into hiding. He had to go to Egypt because he was going to be killed. And when Solomon dies, Jeroboam takes power in the north. And he builds Shechem in the hill country, and he lives there, and he builds Penuel. He's building these old religious sites. Jeroboam said in his heart, "Now the kingdom will turn back to the house of David. If this people go up to offer sacrifices in the temple of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn again to their Lord, to Rehoboam, king of Judah. And they will kill me and return to Rehoboam, king of Judah." He's probably right. So the king took counsel and made two calves of gold. And he said to the people, "You have gone to Jerusalem long enough. Behold your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt." And he set one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. And then this thing became a sin, for the people went as far as Dan to be before one. He also made temples in high places and appointed priests from among all the people who were not of the Levites. And Jeroboam appointed a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah, and he offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he made. And he placed in Bethel the priests of the high places that he had made. He went up to the altar that he had made in Bethel on the 15th day in the 8th month, in the month that he had devised from his own heart. And he instituted a feast for the people of Israel and went up to the altar to make offerings. Now, I read that whole passage instead of just referring to it, because I think sometimes we miss the import of what's going on. The kingdom has split. Rehoboam in the south is technically remaining true. I mean, the people are definitely compromising, but they've got it together more than people in the north, who have even less willpower. What does Jeroboam do? Rather than let people go to Jerusalem, which would threaten his political control, he fortifies this, he builds up this religious site at Bethel, which is actually very close to Jerusalem. If you're going that far south, you might as well go all the way to Jerusalem. But that's the point. He doesn't want them to go there. And in the north, in the beautiful part of the north, at Dan, he builds up a sanctuary, which is probably an ancient sanctuary anyway. I've been there a few times. They found the remains of the altar there. It was huge. And notice the golden calves. Now, I did not list Exodus 20, or I should say Exodus 32 in our list. Exodus 32 is when Moses comes down from the mountain and they're dancing around the golden calf or golden bull. But the bull was sacred in the promised land, just as it was in Egypt, the Apis bull. But in the promised land, the bull is a clear sign of fertility. And we can see Jeroboam is not only adding spice and variety to the religion within Israel, but he's reverting. He's taking the people back to Egypt in their hearts. They've already gone back. And he makes two calves of gold. What else he does, he takes away the requirement for the priesthood. You don't have to be holy, and you certainly don't have to be a Levite, which is good because most of the Levites didn't live around him. They tended to be more faithful to Jerusalem in the south, though it seems to have been a little bit mixed when you read the book of Judges. So he basically lowers the bar for leadership. He creates a rival festival to the Feast of Passover. In other words, they can have all the best of Judaism, all the stuff that they like, but without having to leave home, or at least not having to leave the home territory. He dumbs it down. He simplifies it. He lowers the requirement. You know, any loser can now be a priest. You don't have to be holy. You don't have to truly revere Yahweh. And that's irritating. This pattern persists throughout the Old Testament. And when you read, for example, the book of Amos, who comes later, now another king, also named Jeroboam. Jeroboam II is the king. And just read the book of Amos and see the clash between the lone prophet and those who support this compromised system. 1 Kings 22, I simply wrote outnumbered. And it's similar to Mount Carmel, 1 Kings 19, 19. In 1 Kings 22, Micaiah is outnumbered 400-1 by the false prophets. The false prophets aren't saying anything egregious, at least in this chapter. They're just backing up the political leader, who happens to be Ahab. You know, God separated politics and religion for a reason. And in all the surrounding peoples, you may have noticed from your study of history, the king was a priest. The king could make sacrifices. He could walk into, you know, right up to the altar and do anything a priest could do. In his wisdom, the Lord separated priest and king. King was from the tribe of Judah. Priest was from the tribe of Levi. That guaranteed that there wouldn't be a monopoly, that the king wouldn't take over everything. Now, of course, a little bit off the subject, but in Jesus Christ, kingship and priesthood are brought together. But he's the only one who could be trusted with absolute power. And he's like Melchizedek, who was a priest king. And that's the argument of the book of Hebrews. At any rate, outnumbered 400-1 on Mount Carmel, Elijah was outnumbered 850-1. Read the story. And what is the point? When you take a stand for the true God, you will be outnumbered. There's really no way to make the majority right. We're going to be outnumbered. Well, think of Elijah. You know, he got so depressed in chapter 19. I'm the only one. But what happens there? He thinks he's the only one, and God corrects him. God says, no, there's 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal. So he's completely outnumbered in chapter 18. Although, you know, actually, there were two groups of 50 that the prophet Obadiah had hidden, and Elijah knows that. So there are at least 100 other prophets, 101 more prophets that he seems to have forgotten about. He feels so alone. Sometimes it does feel very alone, taking a stand for God and being labeled exclusive or fundamentalist, even if you're not. And then God reminds Elijah in chapter 19 that there are 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal. Now, perhaps that's a symbolic number, in which case maybe he's saying there are quite a few. If it's a literal number, I'm concerned. Let's say Israel is in the millions. Let's pretend Israel is 7 million. In that case, God would be saying, Elijah, don't get so sad. one-tenth of 1% of the nation are still following me. Well, I don't know what the percentage is. Look at the story of Noah and the flood. You know, 8 in the ark. How many people outside? It's a narrow road. And I have no interest in making the road narrower than it is. But this goes with the territory. When we pursue holiness and one God, we're going to be in a minority. These are just my thoughts. Students, when you share your thoughts, just a few sentences is all you need. I tend to sermonize. Remember, I've been a preacher for 30 years, and I'm giving you a lot more than you need. I'm just really hoping that this will stimulate you. And then we have one in 1 Kings 18, which I see that I put out of order, but it won't really matter. It's similar to that one in Judges. In 1 Kings 18, I wrote down inferior gods. And here's why. Let me read verse 27 and explain. This is, of course, on Carmel. At noon, Elijah mocked them, saying, "Cry aloud, for he is a god. Either he is musing, or he's relieving himself, or he's on a journey, or perhaps he's asleep and must be awakened." And so there's this mockery. Now, in the spirit of gentleness and respect, that's probably not the approach we should take in dialoguing with people from other world religions. On the other hand, I don't think we should be too sensitive. There is a context. There is a place where we can say, this doesn't make sense. That is an inferior God. 2 Kings 17, 7 to 41, may be known to you as the chapter where we find the origin of the Samaritans, is a key text for Old Testament studies. I'm not going to read it out loud because it's very long. But what we find is that with the fall of the north, this is really the result of Jeroboam's sin, the people of Israel compromise in every possible way. They just reflect society around them. And that's why there was a bad feeling between the Jews and the Samaritans, because the Samaritans also compromised. Now, they compromised a lot less than others, but just look at the compromise that goes on. When all restraint is removed, then it's a free-for-all. All religions are equally valid. Oh, that's so much like our culture, don't you think? 2 Kings 23:10. The point of that was to make us think more about who I think is the most horrific of the pagan gods, and that's Molech. And here we read about, it's just so sad to even think about it. Josiah is reforming the nation, the south, that is Judah, around the year 621, I recall. And it says that he defiled Topheth, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom. So think of Gehenna, think of that valley and the fires, that no one might burn his son or daughter as an offering to Molech. So here, long after Solomon, I mean, Solomon got sucked into Molech worship. I think they were into it even earlier, because in Leviticus 18, I believe that's a chapter that's a list of sexual sins, but right in the middle of it is a prohibition against Molech worship. So that's in the time of Moses. In the time of Solomon, centuries later, it's going on. Here in the time of Josiah, another 4 centuries on, they're still doing it. They're still burning their children as an offering to Molech. It's just stunning that that people could do that. Just amazing to me. Okay. So we talked about syncretism, that is blending together of religion, 2 Kings 23, Molech. 2 Chronicles 32:19, religious relativism. Okay, what did I mean by that? And I'm not trying to be cryptic, I was just trying to use fewer words. But this is when Sennacherib is trying to intimidate King Hezekiah. He's destroyed Lachish. That's his base now for the assault on Jerusalem, and Sennacherib will ultimately fail, though it's not known at the time. He sends one of his underlings, the field marshal, the Rabshakeh, to Jerusalem to intimidate. He wants to intimidate the king and all the people, and doing it by speaking in their native language, which is a pretty mean thing to do. Okay, so what do they say? What do the Assyrians say in order to demoralize and to frighten the faithful residents of Jerusalem? It says, they spoke of the God of Jerusalem as they spoke of the gods of the peoples of the earth, which are the work of men's hands. That scripture really hit me when I was a fairly young Christian. I certainly remember it striking me when I was studying religion at Duke University in the late 70s. I remember that I read through the Old Testament the summer of 1980 when I was at Oxford, and I felt very, I don't know if it was intimidated, but definitely outnumbered by people who had some very liberal thoughts. The basic idea is that in comparative religion, all religions are equal. None is really better than another, and to think so is to fail to exhibit charity to your fellow man. You know, it's all about tolerance. I'll comment on that a little bit later on. But the idea that the God of Israel, the God of the Bible, is the same as the gods of the South Pacific or indigenous Native American religions, or the same as the gods of the Sahara or pre-Islamic Arabia, is absurd in the extreme. He's in so many ways the opposite of those gods. He's not sinful. He's not selfish. He's loving. He initiates. He wants relationship with us. He's just. He's wise. He provides for us. So different. So religious relativism says that really your religion is relative to where you grow up. Your God is relative to your culture. If you're born in Arabia, you'd believe in Muhammad. If you're born in India, you'd be worshiping Krishna. And that's a fallacy itself, a genetic fallacy that confuses the origin of the belief with the truth of the belief. It doesn't really matter where you get your idea from. If your belief is true, then it's true. You know, if you learn the times table in a very narrow-minded community, that doesn't mean the times table is wrong. I mean, it can still be right. Let's not commit the genetic fallacy. Let's not succumb to religious relativism. I've referred before to Isaiah 44. It's a long passage, 6 to 20. I always get a bit of a chuckle out of that because here God is mocking the mentality that would cut down a tree and use part of it for firewood and then shape the rest of it into an idol and then bow down to it and worship it and say, "Save me." And so I believe God looks at human religion. It's the mockery of it all, the senselessness of it all. Paul, you may think that's strong, but remember Romans 1, Paul said they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for something that's not God, and they became fools. Okay, let's look now in, I've got so many passages I want us to look at. Let's just keep going through the list. Jeremiah 2:28. I will paraphrase it. You have as many gods as you have cities. This is the concept of the city god. In the time of Jeremiah, he was preaching about 626 to 586 BC. Each town tended to have its own god or favorite god, just as each family had its own household gods. And we see that even as far back as the time of Genesis. So it's not just a question of, is it Yahweh or Baal or Molech or Chemosh? There are probably dozens, scores, maybe even hundreds of gods going on, being worshipped. Now we go to Lamentations. You know, Jeremiah is the before, Lamentations is the after. And I want us to look at this verse in chapter 2. And, of course, this is the after. Jerusalem has been destroyed by the Babylonians. You know, by the way, Old Testament history, knowing Old Testament history really, I think, helps us in our confidence in the narrow road and the truth of and holiness of the God of the Bible. But the false prophets were saying all along, it's okay to blend in, it's okay to cave in to multiculturalism, to relativism, to add a little bit of the other gods. As long as you still worship God, Yahweh, you have your bases covered, even if you compromise and you know, blend politics or sex or any human pursuit with religion. Jeremiah said, no, you can't do that. All the prophets told us that God is jealous. Don't do that. And this is a summary statement. Lamentations 2:14. Your prophets have seen for you false and deceptive visions. They have not exposed your iniquity to restore your fortunes, but have seen for you oracles that are false and misleading. I think the NIV says they have not exposed your sin and averted your captivity. This whole captivity, being destroyed and taken to captivity by Babylon, wouldn't have happened. It could have been averted if sin had been exposed. The false prophets we see in this passage weren't just ones who said, worship other gods. They're ones who made light of sin. Think of those passages in Jeremiah where the true prophet, Jeremiah, says the false prophets and priests said, peace, peace, when there is no peace. And they've treated the wound of my people lightly, you know, as though it were not serious. If you're taking written notes, Jeremiah 5, 30 to 31, 6, I believe it's 13 to 15. I would also look at 7, 4, and I think 23, 23. The false prophets keep repeating their message. You know, I have a dream, I have a dream. Or the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. Or peace, peace. And Jeremiah doesn't multiply deceptive words. He tells them the truth. And I think this is one of the, don't get sucked into this. We're surrounded by people from so many religions. Maybe they're nice and tolerant like the Baha'is. Maybe they're exclusive, but they're very sincere like the Jehovah's Witnesses. Maybe they take a stand for their faith and they frighten us in their commitment like some Muslims. Maybe the Buddhist monks. Exposing sin is a task for any follower of God and any true prophet. And the false prophets did not expose sin. In Ezekiel 8, in the first, I guess it's verses 1 to 18, I won't read that one, but it gives us a glimpse of what's going on even later in the time of the exile. Now, Ezekiel is prophesying even after the exile. And here we find out a lot of reasons that Jerusalem would fall, that it did fall, and the way to compromise was being led. The trail was being blazed by the leaders, by the elders themselves. And so in Ezekiel 8, we see all kinds of idolatry. We see worship of the sun, worship of the sun god. Remember that in Egypt they worshipped Ra, the sun god. In the Middle East, in the area of Canaan, they worship Shamash. In Mesopotamia, Shamash, the sun god. And these men are offering incense and bowing down to images and idolatry. Just read this whole passage and you see, wow, this is amazing stuff. And holding the branch to the nose, that may be a bit obscure, verse 17. That's something that people did in worshiping of Tammuz, or the equivalent of Adonis. So there are many allusions to idolatry here. And it's so sad that you didn't really have to go any farther than the spiritual lives of the leaders themselves. And I think that's a good warning for us, even in our churches. They may be respectable in the community, but being respectable in the community is not all it takes. Daniel 2:11, this you will recognize is similar to that first passage in Judges 9. It's just a passing comment. This is where Nebuchadnezzar says, you're going to have to tell me my dream. You know, not just interpret it, but tell me it. And the astrologers say, the thing the king asks is difficult. The thing the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh, or who do not live among humans. You see, it's that distance. The pagan gods were transcendent, but not transcendent in a majestic way, but they were distant. I mean, they did their own thing. God of the Bible is eminent, not imminent or eminent as in about to happen or as in important, but immanent, I-M-M-A-N-E-N-T. He's here. In him we live and move and have our being. So the God of the Bible is eminent, but also transcendent, higher than the highest heavens. The pagan gods did not understand this. They cheapened the holiness of God, but they also missed out on the personal relation that God enjoys with his people. Today, we cheapen Jesus sometimes by making him our, quote, personal savior, end quote, but without doing what he says. But others look at God in the opposite way. They think he's so distant, so beyond, almost the deistic kind of God, that they spend no time building any relationship. The pagan gods, the pagan religions did not understand how close God was. Of course, Daniel knows that God's right there. Of course he's transcendent, and yet he's immanent, and Daniel's confident he will get an answer. In Daniel 5, verse 4, we see that the king who succeeds Nebuchadnezzar, well, actually, the king who succeeds him, in a sense, is off collecting butterflies in Arabia or something like that. I don't know what he was doing. But Belshazzar replaces Nabonidus while Nabonidus is away, and that's why Belshazzar offers to make Daniel number three in the kingdom instead of number two, because actually he's number two. But Belshazzar has this pagan party, and it involves all the pleasures of the world. And we read that they brought in the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple. Now this is the temple of God, the temple the Babylonians had destroyed. They took out the golden vessels, and then it says that the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. So why does he die that night? Why do the the fingers of that hand appears on the wall, the writing on the wall? Many tekelu parson. It's not just because he's a bad king. He's actually committing the ultimate act of pride, of hubris here. He's using the vessels from the temple of the holy God to toast the false gods, the gods that are not even existent. Nebo and Marduk and all the gods that the Babylonians worshipped. And for that he pays with his life. Now we come to our New Testament passages. These will be more familiar, but I think these are all very important in our discussion on clashing worldviews. John 14:6, Jesus says, He is the way, the truth, and the life. You can deny it. You can say, I don't accept it. Or you can, I guess, say Jesus never said that, which is what some scholars do. Or you can accept it and say, He's the only way. There's a soft interpretation and a hard interpretation. The soft interpretation is that, well, everyone who makes it in the end will make it through Jesus, even if he didn't know it was Jesus. That is, a good Hindu will make it through Jesus. He just didn't know it was Jesus. And I suppose that's one way to take it. Except that earlier, like John 3:17, it says that if you don't believe, you're already in trouble. So, unless you can believe in Jesus implicitly, and perhaps you can, but if you cannot believe in him implicitly, if you have to actually have some understanding and believe explicitly in Jesus, then those who don't know him will not be saved through him. And that's the hard interpretation of John 14:6, that only those who have embraced the gospel are going to make it, because he's the way, the truth, and the life. That's a troubling text, isn't it? I tend to go with the hard view. I would love for the road to be as broad as it possibly can, but I have to have integrity with respecting God's word, and so do you. John 18:38, Pilate is interviewing Jesus, and Jesus says, everyone on the side of truth listens to me. Pilate retorts, what is truth? And a question for his age, it's a question for our time. And of course, the result of not embracing truth is not just compromise, but it's sin. And that's what Pilate does. He sins. He allows an innocent man to die. Pilate was a true politician, and we know from his life, from pictures in the Bible, and from the stories from outside the Bible, the kind of person he was. And when people are relativistic, there tends to be a corresponding character flaw. Acts 4:12, they took note that these men had been with Jesus, and they were impressed by their courage. Well, what was it they actually said? What did Peter and John actually say? Well, I think you know. This is one of the best-known verses in all of Acts. They're not about to back down. They have the courage. And they say, salvation is in no one else, for there's no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. They are exclusive. That's a hard line. I mean, they're not saying, there's only one name, but if you don't know his name and you're a really good fill-in-the-blank, worshiper of Zeus, you'll be fine. Or you can just stay in Judaism. You don't have to become a Christian too. Or, whatever flavor you enjoy. Remember, we're just sharing our opinion here. That's not the way they are. They are very hard line. Okay, time for a comment on tolerance. In the old days, tolerance was tolerance of people, people that you disagreed with, people whose ideas you thought or knew were wrong. Today, tolerance has been radically redefined as tolerance of ideas, that all ideas are equally true, that no one has a claim for truth. And of course, that kind of thinking is disastrous in any realm of life, from science to mathematics to history to psychology to sociology. I can give you a long list and give you some illustrations. But tolerance is anything but tolerance. True tolerance is tolerance when you disagree. Modern tolerance is a tolerance, a false tolerance that says you have to agree. If you don't think the guy's right, you're being arrogant. If you think you're right, then you're being arrogant. But to have tolerance, you have to disagree. You can't tolerate someone that you already agree with. That doesn't make any sense. You tolerate someone you disagree with. So it's been radically redefined, dumbed down, watered down, and this is pouring into the Christian church. It's pouring in the church through youth leaders, through older Christians who don't read their Bibles and don't take a stand, through non-evangelistic Christians. It's pouring in through people who just want Jesus to fix them, but they have no idea of holiness. And we've got to fight this. This is an uphill struggle. We're definitely going against the current. Okay, Acts 14, 11 to 18. Often in the book of Acts, we see the kinds of religions that were being followed in the Mediterranean world as the apostles penetrated with the gospel. And there's a healing, and they see what Paul has done, and the crowd are very impressed, and they shout out in their language, "The gods have come down to us in the likeness of men." Barnabas they called Zeus, and Paul Hermes, because he was the chief speaker. In the Greek pantheon, Zeus was the king of the gods, but Hermes was his messenger boy. So they actually put Barnabas above Saul or Paul, which was interesting. And so the priest of Zeus brings oxen and garlands, and he wants to offer a sacrifice. Of course, the apostle Paul and the missionary Barnabas will have nothing to do with this. They tear their garments. You know, we're just men. We're not gods. There's a difference between man and God. That's a difference that our society's losing right now. We're kind of paganizing the gods, even as we divinize men through the New Age movement. We think that we're God. We just don't know we're God. But they rip their clothes in horror at the thought. And even then, they scarcely restrained the people from offering sacrifice to them. And the result was that Paul is dragged outside the city and stoned nearly to death. The fickleness of the crowd. What fickleness! They think he's a god, and then he says, "I'm not," and then they want to kill him. I mean, this is just amazing stuff. And yet, although this took place in the middle of the first century, it could just as well be happening in the 21st. Acts 17, 16 to 34 is Paul's time in Athens, where he reaches out and he begins with what is true in their religion, although it's not a lot, it's some, and he's able to quote where he can, and he builds a bridge and he shares his faith, and a number of them become Christians. And the unknown God is not an actual God. It's a statue, I think of several of them were actually produced, which was in case they offended one of the gods by not offering a sacrifice to that god. So that was to cover their bases. It's the unknown God. And of course, Paul comes around and he gives new meaning to this term, and he says, well, the unknown God is the God that who's actually very close to you, who's immanent, not just transcendent, who wants to know you and who will judge you through Jesus. Romans 1, 21 to 23 is a classic passage. And it shows how ingratitude leads to idolatry, and through idolatry to all kinds of sin. And I'll just read a little bit of this. And really it says the idolaters have no excuse, because there's certain things you know about God just from looking at the creation. That's verse 20. I'll read 21 to 23. "For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore, God gave them up." And so the result of ingratitude is idolatry. It's not that idolatry starts and then you just have different lifestyle choices and alternatives. No. Idolatry is sinful. There's a refusal to honor God as God, and we manipulate God or the gods. The essence of paganism is manipulation. I get what I want out of God by giving him something he wants. I give him a sacrifice or a prayer or an offering, or I build something and dedicate it to him. I do some good religious deed, and now he's obligated. Now he'll give me what I want. And as long as I get what I want, I'm okay. We're square. It's manipulation. That's the essence of paganism. It's not just worshiping false gods. The essence of paganism is manipulation. I'll just show up to church on certain times and I'll guarantee a certain outcome. I'll say prayers and then good things will happen. When I'm in trouble, I'll get on my knees. Okay, that's the kind of manipulation. Not that we shouldn't get on our knees when we're in trouble. That's just smart. But some people say, you know, Douglas, I think you need to be softer. Because you could be saved just by your conscience if you're a good person. You know, I once heard a preacher, this was in a Church of Christ, and he was preaching to the group that if you didn't know the gospel, you'd be judged by your conscience and you could be saved that way instead. And I went up to him after and I said, my friend, I won't tell you his name, my friend, let's look at what Romans 2 actually says. Because it doesn't say what you're saying. I'd like to read part of that right now. Paul has been making the case that the non-Jews, the Gentiles, need God. They're lost, Romans 1. That even the Jews are lost, chapter 2. And in chapter 3, he will conclude and say that all are lost. But I'm reading in Romans 2:12. For all who have sinned without the law will also perish without the law. All who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law. Maybe your version says, will perish apart from the law. For it is not the hearers of the law who are righteous, but the doers of the law who will be justified. For when Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do what the law requires, they are a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law. I think you're familiar with this passage. But Paul never says that they can be saved by their conscience. He's rather saying there are mitigating circumstances, factors that God takes into account. Because in verse 15 it says their conscience may bear witness for them, or their conflicting thoughts will accuse them. So they could be accused or excused by conscience. In other words, no one will be saved just by being a good person or just by having a good conscience. And secondly, even if you could, having a clear conscience doesn't mean you're innocent. 1 Corinthians 4:4, right? 1 Corinthians 4:4. So Paul's not saying you can be saved by your conscience. He's saying that the Gentiles know enough of the truth they put to shame God's people. Because the Gentiles, when they follow their conscience, sometimes are more righteous, so to speak, than God's people are who have the law. And yet Paul says explicitly in verse 12 that those who don't have the law will perish without the law. Without a relationship with God, without a covenant with God, we have no firm hope of salvation. In the New Testament world, they didn't celebrate the diversity. They didn't celebrate pluralism. 1 Thessalonians 1:9, when those noble people turned to God. They gave up their idols. They turned from idolatry. You say, well, couldn't I remain a Taoist or a Hindu or a Confucianist and believe in Jesus? I guess so, but that's not biblical. I go to India every 2 or 3 years. The Indians are amazing people. I love their food. But one thing that's quite remarkable is how they can blend together so many different religions. Talk about syncretism. I remember once I was in a taxi. I had a lot of experiences in taxis in India. One time I remember, I asked the driver, have you ever hit a cow? Because if you've ever been in India, a lot of the cities, you have cows walking around, you know, Brahma bulls and, you know, cows. And I asked the guy, have you ever hit a cow? And he said, oh no, she is our mother. You know, because the cow is a symbol of Brahma. No, you don't kill a cow, she's our mother. But I remember another taxi had a little statue of the elephant god Ganesha on the dashboard next to a little statue, a little idol of Krishna. And there was one of Jesus. And there was another god. I think he had 5 gods altogether. He worships all of them. And so if you tell a Hindu, I believe in Jesus, he may say, very good. Do you believe in Jesus? Okay, I believe in Jesus. But all they're thinking about is incorporating him, grafting him into the pantheon of gods you already have. But the point of 1 Thessalonians is that you turn from idolatry. You don't just add it on. You ditch the old. You get rid of it. God is holy. He's jealous. He's exclusive. Now don't get us wrong. Christians want all people to be saved because God wants all people to be saved. Now that's a really important verse in evangelism. That he wants all people to be saved doesn't mean that they will, though. 1 Timothy 2:4, he desires all people to be saved and to come to a knowledge of the truth. With salvation must come a knowledge of the truth. You don't get saved if you don't know the truth. You can't reject the truth and be saved. They go together. God wants all people to be saved. And if you like that passage, there's a similar one that I like to use in explaining this. That's in Ezekiel 18:32. It's the last verse in Ezekiel. And the last one, and this is another great one. I use this often in evangelism, and that's Revelation 7:9. And what are you trying to do, Douglas? Scare people? No. This will inspire people. Because even though Revelation has images of judgment, it has an incredible vision. Let me read 7:9. After this I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." I just got carried away when I was reading it. I only meant to read verse 9. I read three verses. But it's a great multitude. And what kind of people are they? Are they all the same? Oh no. From every nation and all tribes and peoples and languages. So there you have diversity. Unity in diversity. They're one. They will be one as the bride of Christ. Here we see the inclusiveness of Christianity. We're often accused of being exclusive. I got that a lot when I was doing my doctorate. You know, it's all about exclusivism. We need to not marginalize people, not be so exclusive. Well, the truth is exclusive. Now, Christianity is exclusive in a way, because if you reject the truth, you won't make it. And it's a narrow road. But I actually say we're inclusive. God's ultimate vision is for all people to have a chance. He would love heaven to be completely full. We're inclusive because we accept everyone. It doesn't matter what you've done, your background. 1 Corinthians 6:9 to 11, for example. Whatever your background. It doesn't matter what race you are, what the education you have, or the class you come from, your gender, athletic prowess, or your power, your wealth. Irrelevant. God wants everyone to be saved, and he sees this incredible vision in Revelation of people from literally everywhere making it. So encouraging. So we have a clash. We have a worldview clash. We mustn't compromise. But standing firm and holding the true God doesn't mean that we're ungracious. In fact, I think the better we understand these vital issues, the more conviction we'll have and the more graciousness. And they both go together. Think again of 1 Peter 3:15 to 16. Hope these thoughts are useful to you. Now, as you rewrite your thoughts, please be brief. Change what you feel like changing. And I look forward to reading it. God bless.